Chapter 4 KISS and Tell. Simplicity wins every time. Great leaders are almost always great simplifiers who can cut through argument, debate, and doubt to offer a solution everybody can understand. Colin Powell. The key to this statement by Colin Powell is that great leaders are not just simplifiers, but that they can communicate to their entire audience in terms that are universally understood. You can't always be listening to your people, as sometimes they need to be listening to you. Whether he falls into the great leader category or not may be debatable, but one of Powell's contemporaries, former U.S. President Bill Clinton, is certainly a good example of a politician with a gift for delivering understandable, no-nonsense messages. In fact, after Clinton had delivered a masterful address at a 2012 Obama election campaign event, I had to chuckle when I heard the White House incumbent jokingly say that maybe he should appoint Clinton as the Secretary of Explaining Stuff. KISS is an acronym for Keep It Simple, Stupid, that is believed to have originated in the U.S. Navy in the 60s. It was directed at system designers in recognition of the fact that most battle systems work better when kept as simple as possible, whereas complexity builds in nothing but problems. Unfortunately, however, the KISS principle is something to which a lot of business leaders and politicians do not seem to subscribe. In my own case, having grown up facing the challenges that come with dyslexia, simplicity in communications has always been more of a necessity than a nicety for me. But whether in our professional or private lives, developing the art of simple, clear speech is something that every one of us, and everyone with whom we associate, can only benefit. For some people, like Bill Clinton, the gift of the gab comes with an innately intelligent and concise delivery. For others, however, it can be anything but concise and frequently utterly unintelligible. One such aggravating example is to be found in BBC Television's brilliant comedy series, Yes, Prime Minister. I don't watch much television, but this show has long been a favourite of mine. It was reportedly also one of the late Prime Minister Margaret Thatcher's few must-watch TV programmes. There is one wonderful character in the show, Sir Humphrey, who is the absolute antithesis of everything KISS stands for. Paradoxically, my old English teacher at Stowe School would probably have described Sir Humphrey as the quintessence of verbosity and polysyllabic pomposity, which we always joked would have been a fair description of that particular teacher as well. In simpler terms, however, Sir Humphrey is a perfect caricature of the kind of person who loves to talk at great length but does so without actually saying anything remotely intelligible. In case you're not familiar with Yes, Prime Minister, here is a snippet of Sir Humphrey at his best, or perhaps more accurately, at his worst. Questions of administrative policy can cause confusion between the policy of administration and the administration of policy, especially when responsibility for the administration of the policy of administration conflicts with responsibility for the policy of the administration of policy. Short and snappy wins every time. Whenever I run into a real-life Sir Humphrey, it's all I can do to prevent myself from grabbing them by the collar and yelling, "Life's too short! Get to the point, will you?" When the person in question happens to be a revered diplomat or captain of industry, such an in-your-face approach isn't always the smartest way to go. But you can take steps to avoid falling into similar bad habits yourself, and in my own case, this has meant trying my best to live by the simple old mantra of say what you mean and mean what you say, and preferably in as few well-chosen words as possible. There are a lot of Sir Humphrey types in business who mistakenly feel they have to assert their authority by continually interjecting with some kind of a comment on anything and everything that's being discussed, when the fact is that if they don't have anything intelligent to add to the debate, they'd come across as much smarter by shutting up and saying nothing. When going into print, the art of distilling one's thoughts into as few words as possible is something that takes practice as well as that often rare commodity of time. The French mathematician Blaise Pascal summed up this conundrum when he famously wrote, "I am sorry this letter is so long. I didn't have time to make it shorter." Twitter wasn't an electronic option when Pascal was around, but with its 140-character limit, tweets have become the champion of economy in words, and as a man of few words, I must say that I love it. In anything I write, I now make a conscious effort to condense the point I want to make into a Twitter-like format. Even if I only manage to get it down to a couple of hundred characters, I can still count on getting my message across much more effectively than if it were 10 times the length. So, a word of advice here to anyone writing an initial pitch document, or for that matter, any written communication, and certainly if it's coming in my direction, anything longer than a one-pager is way too long. In fact, even an email that is longer than a couple of hundred words is not going to hold my or many other people's attention. There are only so many hours in a day, and nobody has the time to wade through long Sir Humphrey-like missives. My friend Larry Page of Google told me that his colleagues all know that sending him anything that is much longer than a tweet exponentially increases the likelihood that he will never find time to read it. Capturing someone's attention in writing is like the process of mooring an ocean liner. First, the thin, lightweight rope, the tweet, gets tossed to the dockhand. This leads to a larger, stronger line, the email, that eventually pulls in the big, heavy mooring hawser, the full presentation. Try throwing out the heavy line first, and like a 5-page email, it will likely sink without a trace. I loathe making speeches. Coming from someone who does a lot of it, such a statement must come as a surprise, but it's almost as true today as it was when I first spoke in public 50-odd years ago. I remember being scared half to death when I had to stand up in front of my school to make a speech. It was a contest where we had to memorize a fairly short speech and present it to the school. If you stumbled at any point, you were gonged, and that was it. You were out. I had actually worked very hard at getting it down pat, and despite my sheer terror, I managed to start out quite well. But a couple of minutes into it, my mind momentarily blacked out. Within a split second, the gong brought me back to reality. I still break out in a cold sweat just thinking back to the excruciating experience. Quite apart from the nervousness, the simple fact of the matter is that I have never particularly enjoyed public speaking, and as with everything else in my life that I don't enjoy doing, I didn't do it terribly well. Over the years, I have become much more comfortable as a speaker, but it still makes me nervous. It is some comfort that I am not on my own with this, as the fear of public speaking, or glossophobia, as it is clinically known, is right up there with the fear of flying as one of the most common human fears. One inescapable reality of business life is that the more successful you become and the higher up the corporate ladder you climb, the more frequent the requirement for you to step up to the microphone. Unlike in government circles, where the ability to deliver a great stump speech gets a lot of otherwise distinctly mediocre politicos elected, in the private sector, as helpful a talent as it may be, I doubt that too many people ever got hired or promoted strictly on the basis of their public speaking abilities. The other sad irony is that while teleprompters are a wonderful crutch for those really big speeches, with a teleprompter, a few beta blockers, and the ability to read, just about anyone can turn in a reasonably respectable performance. Those little glass screens are not something you can easily swing with smaller audiences. The more intimate atmosphere that is found with groups of fewer than 100 makes for a much higher incidence of interruptions and questions, which are not a good idea with a teleprompter. And a word of warning. Over-reliance on technology can be dangerous in lots of ways, but never more so than when it is a teleprompter and you are standing in front of an audience. Things break. I always make a point of having a printed version of my presentation at hand, just in case there are problems. I have, however, seen several people over the years that clearly had not rehearsed their speeches sufficiently well to be able to wing it when they experienced technical problems with their electronic scripts. Something that Transformers director Michael Bay clearly didn't do at a Consumer Electronics Show press event for Samsung. When his teleprompter went on the blink mid-presentation, he looked flustered, stopped speaking mid-sentence, said something to the effect that, "The type is all off," then turned on his heel and walked off the stage, never to return. He later apologized with the understatement that, "I guess live shows aren't my thing." I remember the very first time I used a teleprompter being asked by the technician if I was familiar with them, and, not wishing to appear a novice, I nodded and made like I was an old hand, which turned out to be a big mistake. Within a few minutes of starting my speech, I found myself talking faster and faster in a frantic effort to keep up with the darn thing. It was only after I finished and the same technician who had run the teleprompter said, "Wow, you're a fast talker. I had trouble keeping up with you," that I figured it out. His job was to run the teleprompter at my speed of talking, not vice versa. Having seen that I was a very nervous speaker, the late Gavin Maxwell, author of Ring of Bright Water and other successful novels, gave me some wonderfully helpful advice on speechmaking that has served me well over the years. It takes practice, but it can be done. Close out your mind to the fact that you're on a stage with hundreds of people staring at you, and instead, imagine yourself in any personal comfort zone, like your dining room at home, where you're telling a story to a group of friends over dinner. I know it sounds a little corny, but try it. It has certainly worked for me. I am a huge fan of Sir Winston Churchill. How can you not love someone who, in a 1948 House of Commons speech, could say, "For my part, I consider that it will be found much better by all parties to leave the past to history, especially as I propose to write that history." Somewhat ironically, his words have been massaged by history, and the reinvented quote most often attributed to the great man is now, "History will be kind to me, for I intend to write it." One way or the other, it is an approach that I may well decide to follow myself someday. Churchill is universally recognized as one of the greatest orators of all time, but he only achieved this status on the back of a lot of hard work. He claimed that he averaged an hour's preparation for every minute of a speech. Few, if any, are better equipped to give advice on the subject of public speaking, as these two classic, funny, but right-on-target quotes serve to illustrate. My absolute favorite being the following quote, which is often attributed to him. "A good speech should be like a woman's skirt, long enough to cover the subject and short enough to create interest. Take this advice to heart. Even highly gifted speakers like Churchill would never push an audience into listening to him for more than 25 minutes or so. Extending a presentation beyond 30 minutes is really stretching the attention span of any audience. I put Mark Twain right up there with Ernest Hemingway as one of my favorite American authors. Twain was also a highly acclaimed public speaker who, like Churchill, seemed to enjoy speaking about speaking. He was obviously aware of the common misperception that to be a great speechmaker, you have to be able to make off-the-cuff deliveries. Twain addressed this perfectly in 1899, when speaking at a dinner given in his honour at London's Whitefriars Club. He said, "But impromptu speaking, that is a difficult thing. I used to do it in this way. I used to begin about a week ahead and write out my impromptu speech and get it by heart." Another piece of astute advice to speakers from Twain speaks to the tendency nervous speakers have of taking a deep breath and then, like me with the runaway teleprompter, rushing through it like an express train. It's almost as if, as is usually the case, they just can't wait to be done with it and get off the platform. Addressing this very common affliction, Twain spoke about a rightly timed pause being every bit as critical and effective as choosing the right words. "The right word may be effective, but no word was ever as effective as a rightly timed pause." Before the teleprompter arrived on the scene, I always used to work from index cards. David Tate, who would usually write my speeches for Virgin Atlantic in the US, used to take delight in sticking in the odd strategically placed card that in big letters would just say, "Pause," to ensure I stopped long enough to let a point sink in with the audience. Low tech for sure, but highly effective nevertheless. Twain's other statement on the subject of speaking that made me feel a lot better about my qualms was, "There are only two types of speakers in the world. One, the nervous, and two, liars." The strange fact is that nervousness is good. The best and most experienced public speakers still get nervous, so don't fret about it. A touch of the jitters sharpens the mind, gets the adrenaline flowing, and helps you to focus. At least, that's the theory, and as easy as it is to say don't sweat it, for some people, of whom I used to occasionally be one, the fear of public speaking can be absolutely debilitating. The best way to mitigate it is quite simply practice, 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 and practice some more. Go through it until you are saying it in your dreams, and it will be a lot easier on the day. The no speech speech. So you can, and should, heed all this wise advice. Or you can also consider adopting an approach that I find very helpful when it comes to making speeches to large audiences. I don't do it anymore. Well, maybe that's not strictly true. I do have to make formal speeches every once in a while, but before accepting any speaking engagements, I will always try and get them to switch the format to a question and answer session. Not only do I feel a lot more relaxed and comfortable with a Q&A format, but I also believe that the audience gets a lot more out of it. With a standard 25-minute speech, you might sometimes manage to fit in a few questions from the floor at the end, but it's usually rushed and seldom very productive. With a well-orchestrated Q&A format, however, the audience gets to lead the dialogue, or at least thinks it does, and so I always find myself covering a much wider range of topics than I could ever jam into a prepared address. At the same time, If there is some topic I especially want to discuss, then a pre-planted question or two can always discreetly accommodate such things. Interestingly, since I have adopted this non-speech approach to speaking engagements, I have become, so I am told, one of the world's more highly paid speakers, and as a result have been raising around $10 million per year for charity. Have you ever noticed how, after any formal speech, the audience often spends more time discussing all the things that were not covered by the speaker than those that were? I wish she'd taken some time to explain XYZ, or worse still, and did you notice how he studiously avoided mentioning XYZ, which is what I really wanted to hear about? Even with a good Q&A session, you obviously don't always get to discuss everything you or your audience might like to cover, but at least they have an opportunity to become participants rather than just listeners. And the number one question that I still get asked by audiences almost every time I take part in a Q&A is that old favourite, "Richard, can you please tell us how you came up with the name Virgin?" I suppose I should be grateful, though. They could be asking a lot more difficult ones. Words and phrases best avoided. Whether you are making a formal speech in an amphitheatre, a Q&A in a ballroom, or talking with a group of 20 staff in the boardroom, you should work hard to maximise on your audience's attention level while minimising the chance of any ambiguity and subsequent, potentially damaging, misunderstandings. To this end, here are a few popular words and phrases and sounds that, in my experience, are best avoided. Ums, ahs, you know, and like. Nervous public speakers tend to be even more terrified of public silence. As a result, they rush to fill in every blank that should be a pause, remember what Mark Twain had to say on this, with all kinds of ums, ahs, grunts, and filler words. My generation used to favour sprinkling, you know, into every other sentence, while today's favourite, English language, filler word is like. Some Generation Y-ers can get like more likes into every like sentence than like all the other like words combined. But whatever your predilection, any and all such verbal fillers are best avoided. All they do is drag out the speaking time while adding zero value. I learned a painful lesson on this subject after my first ever radio interview, when, but for the good graces of the late Anthony Howard, I could have made a bit of a fool of myself. Howard was an esteemed journalist, broadcaster, and writer when, for BBC Radio 4, he conducted a pre-recorded interview of a very young and very nervous me talking about the nascent Student magazine. After the taping, I felt the interview had gone surprisingly well, if maybe a tad on the long side. Anyway, before the show aired, Mr. Howard was kind enough to send me two different tapes of my performance. The first tape I listened to was the 10 minutes that would be aired, and I recall smugly thinking how polished, confident, and to the point I sounded. Then I listened to the second tape and came down to earth with a major bump. To my horror, it consisted of nothing except all the ums, ahs, and you knows and throat clearings that had been edited out of the full interview. And what really depressed me was that the outtake tape was by far the longer of the two. That's not a bad idea. Any use of double negatives, such as this, is an open invitation to mass confusion within the audience. Add the word maybe and it gets even more problematic. The takeaway from anyone hearing the CEO saying such a thing can vary from "he loves it, let's push ahead with the project," to a diametrically opposed "he hates it, he specifically avoided saying it was a good idea." So be definitive. if you approve or disapprove of something, be assertive and make your position absolutely clear, making sure you explain why. You're not going to like this, but avoid any such negativity whenever possible. Rather than immediately sowing a seed of doubt with the audience, it's far better to say something like, "This may be a tough nut to crack, but I'm sure we'll get it done." That's certainly different. A statement such as this could be anything from a ringing endorsement to a stinging condemnation, or even an admission of, "I have no idea what the heck this is all about." Differences, like change, can be good or bad, and for every company that differentiates itself by its excellence, there's at least one other that achieves it by mediocrity. We've had better years. This kind of negative half-statement is yet another often-heard cop-out of a comment. People want the truth, not some sugar-coated version of it. Unfortunately, last year was a bad one, followed by an honest explanation as to what is going to be done to learn from it and ensure next year will be better, is a much more positive approach. Let me get back to you on that. When you truly don't know the answer to a question, rather than making something up and possibly looking foolish in the process, this is absolutely the correct response, but only if you take a note of the question and then make certain that you do indeed get back to them with an answer in a timely manner. Even better, make a commitment that I will get back to you by X date. That said, put at the front of just about any sentence, these two little words form what is quite possibly one of the most destructive phrases in the English language. I am constantly amazed at how people can unwittingly shoot down everything they have been saying by using these two words. To most people's ears, "that said" immediately invalidates everything that has gone before and can breed instant resentment in the listener who may have been buying into the subject matter before that was said. As a verbal bridge from the pros to the cons, try using something like, "Of course, we shouldn't overlook..." No comment. I know everyone knows this, but it's still surprising how often this surefire PR disaster phrase seems to slip out. Even if you find yourself in the unenviable position where your legal advisers have said, "We can't tell them, the press, anything at this time," please avoid the no comment at all costs. I'm really sorry, but until we gather all the facts, we are not in a position to issue a statement. We'll play much more favorably on YouTube and or the evening news. A stark no comment, on the other hand, tends to come across like, "We're guilty as hell and don't want to talk about it until our lawyers have come up with a plausible alibi." Okay. Apparently, this is the most universally recognized word on the planet, next to Coca-Cola, and yet it is one of the most ambiguous. The original meaning is rumored to have come from "all correct," but in popular usage, it can mean a wide range of things. One person's "okay" might mean "good," another's "it's adequate," and to yet another's "barely acceptable." It is a word that is also used in a dismissive manner when you really mean to say, "Okay, just don't bother me now." Avoid it. Don't be lazy. If you mean this is an excellent idea, then say so. If you think the idea sucks, then tell them, nicely, that "I don't like it," and give them a few reasons why, so they can learn from it. And lastly, one that may surprise you, but it is a word that can cause as much trouble for Americans visiting the UK as it can for Brits in the USA. The word is "quite." To an American, "quite good" means "very good," whereas to a British ear, it can mean anything from "reasonably good" to "barely acceptable." If in doubt, it's best to avoid it on both sides of the Atlantic, as, using the American connotation, the results can be quite dangerous. Little words that go a long way. So having listed some of the words and phrases I recommend are best avoided, here are a few everyday words and phrases that I strongly suggest using as often as possible. The first consists of seven little words that I sincerely believe might constitute one of the most powerful sentences a business leader can utter. I'm not sure. What do you think? The upsides to popping this question every once in a while are almost innumerable. First of all, if you truly aren't sure of your answer, admitting it will usually spare the other party from a lot of Sir Humphrey-like blather, or blether, as the Scots like to call it. I only know that because my wife Joan has on more than a few occasions said, "Oh, come on, Richard, spare us the blether, will you?" And when this comes from my lovely wife, I usually do, quickly. There will, of course, be some bombastic, "I'm in charge and I'll make the decisions around here" types that will see any admission of uncertainty on their part as an utterly unacceptable sign of weakness in front of their underlings. As far as I'm concerned, however, quite the opposite applies. When a leader displays the self-confidence to effectively say, "Hey, I can't be expected to have all the answers, so I'd love to hear your thoughts on the subject," it not only has a very humanizing effect, but it also tells the employees that their opinions are respected and considered to be of value. Even without the "I don't know," frequently asking simple little questions like, "So what do you think?" or "Are we missing anything here?" will yield all kinds of highly positive rewards. At school, we always knew which teachers made a habit of asking questions and which would just drone on and on and on without asking one question per term. The same applies in the office. If your people know that their opinions may be sought at any moment, they will pay much closer attention and also have to have an opinion at the ready. Speak as you would be spoken to. Please. Now, what I am about to say may not be something you've heard from anyone since your parents used to say it to you when you were growing up. Many of you did actually listen and learn from them, and so this is not directed at you. But at the same time, I'll bet you'll be the first to concur with my position here. I apologize if this comes across in any way as condescending, but there are two tiny but hugely important words that tend to be grossly underused by a lot of people, and quite often, the higher up the totem pole you go, the less you tend to hear the words "please" and "thank you" spoken. We were all brought up to say "please" and "thank you." My mum and dad's rule was a very simple: no please, no get. So why do so many people seem to grow out of the habit? I don't know if it's some kind of a misbegotten status thing, or if it's just sheer bad manners, but I am frequently saddened at how many people just don't seem to use these words anymore. Perhaps today's kids just aren't being taught the social value of such things, but as far as I'm concerned, whether in emails or face-to-face, you simply cannot overuse these two words. It's not just a question of politeness. It's about recognition and respect for your colleagues at every level. Just consider what a difference it makes leading off a conversation with, "Thank you so much for all your hard work on this report," and, as opposed to, "I got your report," and... In the same way, a simple "please" can make a world of difference. "I need this by Monday." It's much less likely to get you there than, "Can you please try and get this to me by Monday?" If you listen to experts like McKinsey and Company on the subject of motivation and employee recognition, they are generally in agreement that, contrary to popular perceptions, money is seldom the prime motivator. In a report titled Insights into Organization, McKinsey agreed that while being fairly compensated is important, so are a lot of other more subtle factors, one of which is pride in one's work. People take a lot of satisfaction from knowing that they're doing a good job and that their efforts are appreciated, and the simplest way to stoke this passion is for leaders to use ample doses of gratitude. A simple thank you when coming from a senior person can go a long way, particularly if they have made a trip to the employee's desk to express it. And if there is an opportunity to extend the thank you into something a little more meaningful, then that will make an even more lasting impression. In addition to the frightening reduction in face-to-face conversations, another casualty in the wake of emails and texts is the handwritten thank you letter. Given their rarity nowadays, however, a well-crafted handwritten thank you note, which in case you've forgotten involves the use of paper, pen and ink and sent in an envelope, is something that really stands out. I send them several times a month to say thank you for something special, offer condolences, congratulations on a newborn baby, or sometimes even to try and sway a business deal that looks to be getting away from us. I remember dropping a line to Mick Jagger in 1991 when we were pursuing the Rolling Stones for Virgin Records, but perhaps the oddest one I have ever sent was when we were trying to sign the Stereophonics to the V2 label. I was told the deal was slipping away, so on a whim, I sent a handwritten note to the mother of the band's singer, Kelly Jones. I had been told that Kelly still lived at home, so I implored his mum to have her son make the right choice, which he did. They signed the deal a few weeks later. As Kelly told me later, "It's quite amazing what a handwritten note from that nice Mr. Branson can do." In recognition of outstanding performance, I occasionally like to surprise employees and their significant others by saying thank you in somewhat grander style than a note in the mail and invite them to stay with us on Necker Island for a few days. One time in 1997, we entertained an entire 20-plus Virgin Atlantic crew that had performed in exemplary fashion when faced with an emergency landing at Heathrow. One landing gear had failed to extend properly, but our captain made what was described as a textbook landing. It may be helped that Tim Barnby, the captain in command in question, was also a former aerobatic champion. Anyway, as much as the crew will always remember the frightening experience on the airplane, I am sure they will also treasure the few days we enjoyed on Necker together. But as the old saying goes, it's the thought that counts. Taking the time to make the gesture is much more important than its size. So, if you don't have a private island to share with your people, try something like giving them a surprise day off. Take them out for lunch, or give away those seats you have for a sporting event that you probably weren't going to use anyway. At the very least, walk over there, shake their hand, and say a heartfelt thank you. So whether communicating via the written or the spoken word, try and make "keep it simple, stupid" your mantra. And while you're at it, you should also work on adding a third S for short. If you can rigorously adhere to the KISSS principle in all your communications, you will not only have much better informed and more engaged employees, shareholders, and customers, but you will also save yourself and your company a lot of heartache.